We hope this message from Word of Life Church is a blessing to you.
Our opening text for tonight comes out of the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 6, and we're going to be reading verses 25 through 30. We'll have it on the screen for you all to follow along. Starts in verse 25 with the words of Jesus, who says, "Therefore I tell you, do not be anxious about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, nor about your body, what you will put on. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap, nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they? And which of you, by being anxious, can add a single hour to his span of life? And why are you so anxious about clothing? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. But if God so clothed the grasses of the field, which today is alive and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, will he not much more clothe you? O you of little faith." Tonight's message is entitled, with those famous words of Jesus, "O you of little faith." These words are so famous, we still use them today, if you will, as a phrase that we reply to the critics, if you will, the naysayers, the haters. When we go to make that half-court basketball shot, they're like, "You can't do it." We say, "Oh, you of little faith, watch me." Or when we have that grandiose idea that no one else seems to believe in, that no one else seems to say will work, we say, "Oh, you of little faith." When we encounter people that say, "There's no way you can restore and revive this business. It's long gone, man." "Oh, you of little faith." These are the words that we're going to explore tonight. The words of Jesus, the words he uses five times in the Gospels. "O you of little faith." Four of those times are found in passages in Matthew, once in Luke. But the passage in Luke parallels the passage that we just read in Matthew. So we've already covered that, but I do want us to look at the next three passages in Matthew where Jesus says these words, "O you of little faith." This first time that we hear it is on the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus is in the context of teaching. He's teaching a crowd, a congregation of people. But the next three times that we hear the words, "O you of little faith," come from the mouth of Jesus. It's in the context of the disciples on their journey with Jesus, just living life. And when they come up against different and varying circumstances. The first one that we find, this first story, is a story that Perry shared with us last week. If you weren't here last week, I want to encourage you to get the podcast. It was rich. It was good. She said she wasn't here to preach. She was just telling stories, but I think sometimes they're one and the same because she was preaching last week. And if you weren't here, I encourage you to get that. But let's just recap for those of us who were here, the story in Matthew chapter 8. It's a story after the Sermon on the Mount, and Jesus is weary, he's tired, he's been teaching. This is his most famous sermon yet. He's put it all on the line out there, and now he's exhausted. And we find that Jesus is in the boat on the Sea of Galilee with his disciples. You know the scene. Jesus is so exhausted that he just lays down right there on the boat and goes to sleep. In the middle of his nap, whenever he's snoozing, there seems to be a storm that arises. And apparently the Sea of Galilee is quite famous for the fact that the storms on those waters can create quite chaos. And the disciples are caught in one of these storms that have whipped up, and they are in the middle of the Sea of Galilee, and all of a sudden they are filled with fear. And these disciples are not rookies. They're not first-time wayfarers, if you will, on the sea. They're veterans. They grew up fishing. They know the Sea of Galilee like it's their own backyard, and yet they are filled with fear. This is a real storm. This is a real situation. They feel like things are completely out of control and so consumed with fear that they've decided to resort to their last idea for survival, and that is, I guess we just wake up Jesus and see what happens. They wake up Jesus and said, "Look, Lord, we're in the middle of this storm. It's chaos. It's out of control. We have no control of the boat. We are going to perish." And let's look at what Jesus says in verse 26 of Matthew chapter 8. And he said to them, "Why are you afraid, O you of little faith?" Then he rose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. It goes on to say that the disciples marveled. I mean, I know we've been following Jesus, but even the wind obeys him. It's the first story when Jesus says, "O you of little faith." The second story is found in chapter 14 of Matthew. This is the famous story of Peter walking on the water. Jesus had just Jesus had just multiplied the fish and the loaves for 5,000 people, all right? Crazy, awesome, famous miracle. And now we find Jesus, the crowds are following him, he's ready to retire for the day, he says, "Let's go to the other side." In fact, he says, "Why don't you go ahead of me? I'm gonna retreat to the mountain to pray." So Jesus goes to the mountain, he prays, he says, "I'll catch up with you later." The disciples are gone, and then at 4 o'clock in the morning, Jesus shows up, but not in the form that they expected. You know the story. Here's the disciples, they're just rowing along. It's in the middle of the night out on the dark sea. They don't have lights on their boats like we do today. If you can imagine, it's pitch black, and they see this form out on the water, and they say, "This must be a ghost." And these scraggly sailors, these men, you can imagine just chest hair everywhere, beards, right? They smell like fish for life because they've dealt with them so much. They can't get it out of their skin. You know, these are just men. I got scars on their faces. You know, this is my view of them anyway. May not be yours. You might like baby skin disciples. But for me, this is how I imagine the disciples, you know? And all of a sudden, these men turn into little boys, right? "Oh my God, it's a ghost." I mean, really, it's like, this is recorded in scripture. They think it's a ghost and they're terrified until Jesus says, "Don't be afraid, it's just me, it's Jesus." And at this point, the disciples who are full of fear, all of a sudden, at least Peter is full of faith, right? He goes from fear to faith and he says, "Lord, if that's you, then bid me come to you that I might walk on the water and meet you." And Jesus bids him come. He says, "Come on, Peter, I invite you out." And with a leap of faith, can you imagine how much confidence Peter has at this point in Jesus? Right here in this moment, he literally, like some of you have done over a bathtub, thinking you can walk on water, with a bit of confidence, steps onto the water. Now, where you may have failed, I don't know. If you have walked on water, I'd love to talk with you. But Peter actually walks on water. It's phenomenal. Can you imagine it for just a moment, this scene? And he's walking, and then it says a wind began to stir. This familiar wind, like we read about in chapter 8, begins to stir up on the Sea of Galilee. And Peter takes his eyes off Jesus and starts to look at the wind, starts to focus on the storm, and his feet begin to sink. And he becomes once again full of fear. It's a roller coaster between fear and faith. Full of fear, it's a ghost, to faith, I'm going to step out on the water, to full of fear, I'm sinking, what's happening? He says, things are out of control. He yells out, "Save me, Lord." And what does Jesus reply with? Verse 31 out of Matthew 14, Jesus immediately reached out his hand and took hold of him, saying to him, "O you of little faith, why did you doubt?" Why did you doubt, Peter? That I have everything under control? Why did you doubt? I'm right here. I'm the same Jesus that was here just 2 seconds earlier before you took your eyes off me. Why did you doubt? Oh, Peter, oh, you of little faith. And the third and final story that we're going to look at out of Matthew is out of chapter 16. In Matthew 15, Jesus just multiplied the loaves again for the second time, feeding the 4,000. So the disciples now have been present for 2 miraculous encounters with the wonder-working power of Jesus, where he takes what seems to be insufficient resources and multiplies them to feed the multitude. Feeds the 5,000 and then feeds the 4,000. And right after this miracle, Jesus went on to the other side. He finds himself in conflict with some Pharisees and Sadducees, arguing as he often did. And the disciples are behind him. And on their way across the sea to meet Jesus, they find out, oh my goodness, we forgot the bread, guys. Big problem, right? It's like when your wife asks you to pick up bread and milk on your way home, and you get halfway home and you realize, I forgot the bread. And this happens to me all the time. She calls me 3 times while I'm at the store. Remember, I asked you to grab this. And without a doubt, there will be a time that I still forget. The disciples do this. They forget the bread. And so they're thinking, gosh, guys, we failed again. You can imagine Andrew saying, Peter, did you get the bread? No, I didn't get the bread. I thought you were getting the bread. And then out of the 12 of them, no one got the bread. It's mealtime, I suppose, because they're taking bread across. They meet Jesus, and him being a bit flustered, I guess, from his conflict with the Pharisees and Sadducees, sees the disciples and he goes, yo, hey guys, beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and Sadducees. Watch out for their bread. Watch out for that stuff they throw in the mix. And all of a sudden it says that the disciples thought that he was scolding them for not having the bread. This is what it says. And then chapter 16, verse 8. This happens. But Jesus, aware of this conversation between the disciples, man, Jesus is really upset. We forgot the bread. I bet he's hungry. Man, we had our one chance to shine and we dropped the ball. He said, Jesus, being aware of this, said, oh, you of little faith, why are you discussing amongst yourselves the fact that you have no bread? It's like Jesus is just like on the table saying this, beating his head over and over. Oh, you of little faith. Guys, I just fed 4,000 people, not to mention the 5,000 I just fed, you know, months before. Do you not get it? Bread's not the issue here. Why do you keep worrying about having enough resources? Do you understand that you're walking with the source of life itself? Do you get it? Oh, you of little faith. I have things under control, Jesus says. Each time Jesus says these words, oh, you have little faith, to the disciples, he seems to be rebuking the fear of the disciples. He seems to be rebuking the worry of the disciples, the lack of trust and belief that the disciples have in the reality that Jesus is in control. We see the lack of this belief in the reality that Jesus is in control in the first story with the storm. Think about what the disciples are thinking in this moment. Come on, Jesus, the weather is completely out of our control. It obeys no one. It does what it wills, and we are victims. You see, Jesus, it's the stability of the roof that we build that protects us from the weather, the storm. And don't you see? We don't have that stability right now because we are outside of that which we've built to protect us from the storm, and now we're vulnerable, Jesus, and it's out of our control. The second story, we see this with Peter walking on the water. He says, come on, Jesus, I'm on water here and I'm sinking. There is nothing I can do. You see, because I have built a boat, which is my safety from sinking in the water. I find safety in the boat that I have built to prevent me from sinking in the water in life. And now I'm outside of that, which I have constructed for my safety. And in the third story, we see the disciples probably thinking, Jesus, do you understand when the bread is gone, we don't have bread, we don't eat. We can't just conjure up more bread. And if we want more bread, we need money to go buy bread. But maybe they just spent their last dime on the bread that they forgot, and that's why it was a big deal. And Jesus, you don't understand when the money's out. I know that, Jesus, you're not a math guy. You're more of a literature guy. You work with words. But if you don't have money, you don't eat. Economics 101. You see, Jesus, it's the security that I have from my own economic well-being that keeps food on my table. It's when in life we feel like we have lost stability, safety, and security that we feel that everything is out of control. When everything that we've spent our life building to bring us stability, when everything that we've built to bring us safety, when everything that we've built to bring us security comes falling apart, or we find ourselves outside of those things in a situation where we feel vulnerable, we have this feeling that life is out of control. Maybe some of you are in a circumstance right now where you literally, you just feel like Peter on the water and you're just sinking and there's nothing you can do about it. The storm is raging and there's nothing you can do about it. Your table is empty and you feel like, God, there's nothing I can do about it. We must remember that this is the disciples that Jesus is rebuking with these words, "Oh, you of little faith." These are not just atheists, ragtag young guys running around. These are the disciples. These are the ones who were just crazy enough to follow Jesus, who were just crazy enough, who had just enough faith, who were wild enough to give up all that they had going in life to follow this man Jesus. They're not the ones who said, "Oh God, I got to go bury my father first," or, "Man, I can't sell everything I have and give to the poor. That's just a little too far, Jesus." These are the guys that said, "Yeah, I'm in. I'll follow you, Jesus." They're the ones who, in an act of faith, stepped into an entirely new life to follow Jesus. They no longer were collecting taxes at the local tax booth. They were no longer in the family business of fishing. They left all that behind. How? In faith. Maybe you find yourself in a place where you feel like life is out of control and you're full of fear, instability, you're unsafe, you're insecure, full of doubt and anxiety. But you were one of those disciples who at one point was full enough of faith that you said, "Yeah, God, I'm going to step out of the life that I've known into something entirely new." But now you found yourself in a different circumstance where faith seems to be lacking. The disciples, even though they were following Jesus, found that there were times where they seemed to be outside of their sense of stability, safety, and security. At times, they would look at their situation with hopeless doubt and fear, fear of loss or damage. Countless times we see this with the disciples. Countless times we experience in our own life as we follow Jesus. And each time Jesus speaks to the disciples with their worry, with their anxiety, with their doubt, with their fear. He says, "Oh, you of little faith." And as he speaks those words, he reminds them, oh, that's right, Jesus. You told us about this. Sermon on the Mount, Jesus, where you first spoke those words, "Oh, you of little faith." He reminds them, look at the birds. Look at the birds of the air. Look at the flowers of the field. Don't be anxious. Don't worry. Don't be afraid. That's what Jesus reminds his disciples of every time. "Oh, you have little faith. Remember what I taught? Look at the birds. Look at the flowers. How much more does your heavenly Father care about you? So don't be anxious. Don't be full of worry. Don't be full of fear." In the midst of chaos, my hope is that we hear the words of Jesus, reminding us to look around, to look outside our crazy, obsessed world that we've created, that we've built, and for even just a moment to catch a glimpse once again of the world that God created. And in fact, God did create it, this world that we live in. Yeah, it's a hot topic right now. If you've been keeping up at all with kind of the culture wars of our time, this question of creation, right? Faith versus science. The culture war seems to pin faith against science, which, first of all, I've said it before, I'll say it again. I am just in total disagreement of the entire fight that's set up, because I don't think that faith and science are enemies whatsoever. But in the culture wars, if you've been at Word of Life Church for any time, you know that we're not called to take a side, but rather to imitate Jesus Christ in the midst of our culture wars. But it still exists. If you've been Keeping up at all, you know, there's this big debate between Ken Ham and Bill Nye the Science Guy, which I don't know Ken Ham, but I know Bill Nye because I watched him like every science class in seventh grade. I guess my teacher just felt like it was a good education. I don't know. I still remember it though, the song anyway. Bill, 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 Bill. Anybody? Anybody? Yes, Bill Nye the Science Guy. All right, I'm done singing. Okay. I want to take a moment, just a few moments, and I have some really fascinating things that I want to share about Genesis 1, this creation account that we find in our scriptures, about God creating the world. I've been reading a book this week which is intriguing. I mean, it just, it's one of those books that suck you in, you know those books. And it's not a Chronicles of Narnia or a Lord of the Rings type book. It's called The Lost World of Genesis 1, Ancient Cosmology and the Origins Debate. Great reading. If you are interested in this debate, though, if you're not satisfied with the options that you feel like you've been given when it comes to the creation account and reconciling what they would say scripture with science, I would highly recommend this book. It's a great book by Dr. John H. Walton. Again, the title is The Lost World of Genesis 1 by Dr. John H. Walton. John H. Walton is professor of Old Testament at Wheaton College. He has written many books on the Old Testament and its ancient Near Eastern background, including commentary on Genesis, ancient Israelite literature and its cultural context, and he co-authored the IVP Bible Background Commentary on the Old Testament. This guy is legit, all right? He knows his stuff, and this is a great book all on Genesis 1. There's a few things, I'm not going to go through it all, that I want to share this evening that I think will help us in the midst of our conversation tonight. One of the things that Dr. Walton's book is he provides a thesis. This is what he says. When he says we approach Genesis 1, he would recommend, he would say this is how we should approach it with what he calls, and this is big words because I'm not talking to teenagers tonight, the cosmic temple inauguration view. That's his thesis. The point of his book is to say when we read Genesis 1, the creation account, we should read it with a cosmic temple inauguration view. What are you talking about? Let me unpack it a little bit tonight. This is what he means. When we see in Genesis 1 that God created, what we see is God giving purpose. He in fact says, and I'll say it tonight, I believe that God created the material world, that there is something out of nothing, and that happened because God created it. But, and Dr. Walton says that too, but what he says is that we lose the emphasis in the creation account of the fact that God is giving purpose and function of all that exists in the creation account. When you read it, that God is definitely assigning function. In fact, he gets into how people understand existence and how we all are formed by a post-enlightenment world, that something exists because my five senses can experience it, but in the ancient world, something exists because it has purpose and function. As if a computer has all of its parts and hardware and everything, but without electricity, does it really exist? And then once it has electricity, even though it's there, without a program or an operating system, does it really exist as a computer because it doesn't function yet as a computer? You know, I'm not going to get into it, but this is called a discussion on ontology. The beautiful thing about Genesis 1 is this. All of that aside, just get this. That in the creation account, God is bringing about purpose and order, giving everything its proper place, its proper function, its proper purpose. Let's recap. Day one, God says, let there be light. And God separates the light from the dark, and he says he calls the light day and the dark night, assigning function, putting it in its proper place. And then it goes on to say, and there was evening and morning. This is the first time we hear this because right now, this is when God, in fact, out of the disorder and chaos, that which was formless and empty, now we begin to see order. And on day one, we see the order of time. The order of time in day one, day and night. Day two, God creates an expanse, separating the waters. the waters that are above from the waters that are beneath. They understood this as, if you will, the heavens, but we call it the sky, the atmosphere. They would see it as a canopy when they would hear the creation account. They would imagine there's the canopy that holds the rains in the sky from the waters below. Out of the disorder in day two, God creates the order, the function and purpose of weather. This is when he begins to draw together weather patterns. Day three, God gathers together the water on the earth to reveal dry land. And then it says all sorts of vegetation and trees begin to pop up from dry land that they might bear seed and fruit. In day three, God is bringing out of the chaos and disorder that was our cosmos, he brings about the order of food, or if you will, the provision of food, sustenance. And in the first 3 days, God brings about order out of disorder, stability out of instability, peace out of chaos. He brings about the very three things that are the foundation of life itself: time, weather, and food. We go on in day four through six. We see day four, God brings about the purpose and function of the moon and the sun. Day five, the purpose of animals to multiply and reproduce. He fills the seas with them, the land with them. Day six, that glorious day. See, we're all full of pride when mankind was created, and he was created in God's image with the function to bear God's image in actually stewarding the world that God had created, enacting that which God had placed upon humankind to function, if you will, as the icon, the image of God in our world. See, God's world is like the cosmos, and yet in our world, beneath that expanse where we live here on earth, he says, okay, you're to be like my image and govern this world, steward this world. And then on day seven, Genesis 2, this is where I get excited. This is where it all begins to make sense. Day seven, and God rested. Now, we all, most of us, I'll say, I'm not going to make generalizations, but most of us, when we read that, we think God was hard at work. Can you imagine how much energy it would take to create the world and in 6 days? You better believe I'd be resting on the seventh day, by God. Once again, projecting our image on God, if you will. Yes, God does rest. The word there in Hebrew is sabbat. I'm probably butchering the pronunciation, but sabbat, which is where we get the word Sabbath. It's the root for Sabbath, this idea of a seventh day rest under the law of Moses. Sabbat. It's the idea that we have of taking a nap, resting. It's the opposite of work. It's doing nothing. And we have in our head on the seventh day that God rested, that he did nothing, that he's been at work and now he's not. But this is interesting. Exodus chapter 20, verse 11. God is giving his 10 commandments to Moses, and he recounts, as he gives the commandment for the Sabbath, he recounts the creation story, the reasoning for this seventh day rest. Exodus 20, verse 11. This is the words of God to Moses: "For in the 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy." That word rested right there in Exodus chapter 20, verse 11, is not the word sabbat. It's a different word. You would think that the language would just be the same as it was told in Genesis 2, the beginning there, where it describes God rested on the seventh day. But here, it's the word nuha. I'm probably butchering that too. Nuha. Instead of the idea of resting, laying down, taking a nap, doing nothing, this is the idea of dwelling. Nuha is this idea of dwelling, if you will. After a war has been fought, now the people enter into the land to nuha, to dwell within it, to rest within it. Now that the calamity and the chaos have subsided, we can dwell. It's like this. If you've ever moved, you will understand what nuha is about, all right? If you've ever had to move, you know it goes something like this. You have all of the work of, first of all, you have your new house, you have your old house. Then you have all the stuff, which you always wonder, how did I get so much stuff? Right? It's like, if I have the space, I'm going to fill it. All right? Some of you are that way. If you're like my grandmother, I had to hide stuff because she always threw my stuff away. And so I'd have to hide the important stuff. But you have stuff. So you pack your stuff in boxes, and then you have to load those boxes in a U-Haul, which you had to go down and rent, which takes like 4 hours to even just get your truck. And then, you know what I'm talking about. God. And then you have to drive your truck to wherever your new house is, unload all the boxes, unpack, get everything situated, put the beds together, bring the mattresses in, all without trying to nick walls, all without banging up your new house. And then the hardest part of all, you've got to find people to help you do all of this. My dad had a brilliant idea once. He said, I think we should just create a culture change where when people ask if I can help them move, I just say, well, I'll give you $50 towards a moving company. Because I'd rather pay you $50 than have to help you move all day. I think I'm in agreement. Here's the thing, though. Once you're all moved in, it's time to rest. And rest you will. Sleep well, you will do. But you get up the next day, and if you just do nothing in that new house, you say, well, all the work is done. And you don't keep the floor swept. You don't vacuum the carpet. You don't change the light bulbs when they go out. You don't keep a fresh coat of paint on the house when it starts deteriorating. You don't check the filter in the furnace, the air conditioning system. If you don't maintain that house, if you don't reign and rule over that house, it will go to pot. Because though you may rest in your home now, this is a place of rest, of dwelling, you still have to maintain. There's still the work of reigning and ruling. This is the idea of Nuha. And Exodus 20 wants us to understand, it's brilliant, that on the seventh day, God says, now that I've moved in, I've created the cosmos, everything is in order, it's stable, it's secure, it's safe. I am now going to take up residence in the cosmos of which I've created, and I'm going to dwell there. Nuha, reigning and ruling. The creation account, if anything, is the story of God building a cosmic temple in which he will dwell, reigning and ruling. And if the cosmos is the temple, then we are those statues in the temple, the icons of God himself. But that's for another message. Isaiah 66, it's not in my notes, but I'll share it with you. The prophet Isaiah saw it like this. He says, God's message, heaven's my throne, earth is my footstool. What sort of house could you build for me? What holiday spot reserved for me? I made all this. I own all this. God's decree. He's saying, what kind of temple can you build me? The cosmos is my temple. The heavens are my throne and the earth my footstool. So what happens on the eighth day then? What is God doing on the eighth day? He's still reigning and ruling. In his temple, dwelling in his cosmos. On the ninth day, still reigning and ruling. On the 10th, 11th, 12th, millennia later, he's still reigning and ruling. This is what the seventh day reminds us of. God is still reigning and ruling. God's in control. On the seventh day, we rest knowing that God is at work. That's what the Sabbath command's about, that we rest knowing that God dwells here in the cosmos, that he's reigning and ruling. That though we work and we work and we work and we work, at times we must take up our head from our work and peer out a window, peer out a door, step out a door, find a clear night sky to gaze upon and remind ourselves, oh, God is reigning and ruling. It's not about what I can build for my stability, my safety, my security. It's about the fact that the Creator is still creating each and every day, again and again and again. And each day he places the birds in the air at perfect peace. Each day he brings them the worm, the morning worm. Each day he causes the flowers of the field to shine with beauty, again and again and again. G.K. Chesterton writes these words that are beautiful. They're up on the screen for you to follow along. He says, "The thing I mean can be seen, for instance, in children. When they find some game that they specially enjoy, a child kicks his legs rhythmically through excess, not absence, of life. Because children have an abounding vitality, because they are free, spirit fierce and free. Therefore, they want things repeated and unchanged. They always say, 'Do it again.' And the grown-up person does it again until he is nearly dead." Y'all know what I'm talking about. "For grown-up people are not strong enough to exult in monotony." Then Chesterton goes on to say, but perhaps God is strong enough to exult in monotony. It is possible that God says every morning, "Do it again," to the sun, and every evening, "Do it again," to the moon. It may not be an automatic necessity that makes all daisies alike. It may be that God makes every daisy separately, but has never got tired of making them. It may be that he has the eternal appetite of infancy, for we have sinned and grown old, and our Father is younger than we. Beautiful words. What if once again we could return to a childlike faith? Like those first steps that we took in following Jesus. Band, you guys can come on up. I'm going to be closing. What if we could return to a childlike faith? What if we could take upon the nature of a God who has an eternal appetite of infancy? Do it again every day. Faith, like a child, has no worry, no fear, because he or she knows that my Father's in control. When God says, "I'm in control," we actually believe it with childlike faith. Not with skepticism, not with doubt, not with fear. We believe it. Instead of looking around at the world with mature, grown-up eyes and repeating the worried, anxious cycle of fear and insecurity, because things seem as though they are unsure. Time seems to be passing by too fast. The ground we stand on in life seems as water in which we are sinking too quickly. And the food on our table seems all but abundant. Instead of looking through those mature grown-up eyes that see all those things, may we gain the eyes of a child, the faith of a child. I believe that God grows weary for us, not frustrated with us, but weary for us, like watching a child fail over and over again. Weary for us as we repeat time and time again the worn out words of worry. And he replies to us, "Oh, you of little faith." He says, "Look away for a moment from the disorder. Your unstable situation, your chaos, and take a look at the birds in the air. Your Father cares for them. How much more does he care for you? Look at the flowers of the field. He clothes them with beauty, splendor beyond the greatest king that ever was. How much more will he care for you? What can a man add to his life? Not even an hour by worrying about it. It's out of your control. But God is the one who created the order of time. It's in his control. And each and every day we work, work, work. But there are times in our work that we must take our eyes from the ground on which we labor and point them upward towards our Creator, the one who is in control. We must find that window to look out, that doorway to step through, that night sky to gaze upon and remind ourselves of the words that Jesus says, "Don't be anxious, don't worry. I'm still reigning and ruling. The cosmos is still my temple. The heavens my throne. The earth my footstool. And guess what? We are the church, the ones who he is plucking out of this world of worry and building a new temple, a new Jerusalem, a new heavens and earth. And we are living stones of this temple in which we believe that God is still reigning. Jesus came. He died upon a cross. And we see God is king. He's always been king. He's always been reigning and ruling. We are the ones that now recognize that. And as the birds and the flowers of the field remind us, we are to go out from this place reminding the world that the creator of this place is reigning and ruling. Don't be anxious. Don't worry. Don't be full of fear. So tonight, would you stand on your feet? And as we go out from this place, I encourage you to take your anxiety, your worry, your fear, which are all real things. We live in this world. It would be ignorant to say that it doesn't seem like it's got things in order sometimes. It would be ignorant to say that the world is all stable and secure. But faith is to have eyes to see things that are not yet as though they were. To believe that though it doesn't look like God is in control, the storm is raging, I'm sinking, we don't have food. Wait a second. Look at that bird. Look at that flower. Look at the grass. Beautiful. I can hear the creek behind my house. Oh man. It just keeps flowing and flowing. God is in control. I don't have to worry. I don't have to fear. I don't have to doubt. So be full of faith. If it's only just a mustard seed, that'll do. Just a little bit will do. He's in control. You don't have to be. We rest in the reality that God is at work. Tonight, as we close, I would like to share a prayer with you. It's from the New Zealand Book of Common Prayer. They have their own. Imagine that. Pretty cool. It was actually written in conjunction with some indigenous people there, so there's more of a focus on God's creation and things. And I was out with the high schoolers in Colorado and the beauty of the mountains, which, if you're ever out there, the expanse of the mountains reminds you without a doubt, whew, God is a big God. He's in control. And I was sitting there with Father Fred, the guy that runs the retreat center. It was an Episcopalian retreat center, so they know the Book of Common Prayer pretty well. And he shared this with me, and I just thought tonight that I would share it with you. So would you bow your heads and just take in this prayer and make it your own? This is from the night prayer from the Book of Common Prayer of New Zealand. Lord, it is night. The night is for stillness. Let us be still in the presence of God. It is night after a long day. What has been done has been done. What has not been done has not been done. Let it be. The night is dark. Let our fears of the darkness of the world and of our own lives rest in you. The night is quiet. Let the quietness of your peace enfold us. Enfold us, all dear to us, and all who have no peace. The night heralds the dawn. Let us look expectantly to a new day, new joys, new possibilities. In your name we pray. Amen.